Welcome to the Volunteer Youth Worker Podcast. Youth ministries rise and fall on the volunteers. So we are here to encourage and equip you. Join the conversation as we tackle the practical questions you are asking so you can help the next generation know Jesus.
All right, everybody, welcome back. We've got a conversation here with my friend Cody Matchett. And Cody, this is going to be a lot of fun. You've been talking with our audience since we're recording, I guess, at the end of our conference tour.
Yeah, that's right.
We've been in five different cities across our country of Canada, and you were at a number of them. And so this is really, really exciting that we get a chance for everybody in our audience to be able to hear you. Before we get into it, I know people have seen kind of the title of the episode. They know what's coming up. But before we get into it, why don't you fill people in? Where are you coming to us today? Kind of what's your role? If people don't know you, how do you introduce yourself?
Yeah, that's great. First, let me just say I'm just honored to be here, grateful for the invitation and the opportunity. I think both at the events, I was at three of the events across Canada, but even still here now to be whispering to all of you in your ears, if you will. I live in Calgary, Alberta, God's country, the Canadian Texas, as I jokingly often say. And I pastor there with my wife, Brianna, is a counseling therapist, and I'm a pastor. We have two kids who are young, so we're in that stage. I also have my foot in a sort of bit of a different world where I did my master's degree in New Testament, and now I'm a PhD student in New Testament. And my master's work was with a scholar called Scott McKnight. Many of you will know Scott's name. He's written many books, most recently A Church Called Tove, which people really love. And if you haven't read the Tove book, you should read the Tove book. There's a follow-up coming out at the end of this year, which I think is also going to be a great book. I think it's called Pivot. I think it was just announced recently. Such a COVID word, which is sad. But anyway,
the churches that aren't called Tove.
That are going to become Tove. Yeah, that's exactly right. but yeah, so I pastor, and then I have a foot in this academic world. And then part of my master's work was I was a TA or a teaching assistant for Scott. And then he invited me to be a part of this book project and then to be a co-author on a book on Revelation. And so, yeah, so that's a little bit of these two worlds that I get to swim in. I pastor regularly and weekly here in Calgary. And then I also get to do this other research and writing and content stuff in the other part of my time.
And because we reference Texas and Alberta, we should also say that you, when you moved to Calgary, you moved to the part that wasn't necessarily the Texas experience. Like the inner city of Calgary would be a different experience, right? Than if you're in the outskirts.
That's often my joke. I mean, obviously, we can joke for days about cowboys out here, but I've said this.
Of which you would not identify as a cowboy, correct?
Those who have seen me know I'm not a cowboy or a rancher, not even remotely close. Yeah, no, my joke has been Calgary's funny because my wife and I live in the Beltline, which is connected to the downtown core. For those of you who do know Calgary, if you don't, it's fine. We live downtown. And so our lived experience is much more of a progressive inner city experience. But if I were to drive 25, 30 minutes in any given direction, you know, you will face the kind of rural, not face, you will encounter and experience lovely people who would be the sort of on the opposite end of both the political spectrum in terms of the way their worldview spectrum, the way they see the world and understand the world. And so it's a really unique thing for us. And we've really held that close to our hearts of like, we want to be in the heart of the city to know the comings and goings of the city and also to pastor through the things that you pastor when you live in an inner city.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Okay, before we dive too far in, I also want you just to share a story. I don't actually know where these stories might go, but you were with us and met our youth workers in Saskatoon and Winnipeg and Edmonton as well. Obviously, you know lots. We were in Moncton. That's where you and I both have grown up and seen lots of people there too. Tell me about some
God's real
country. Your events. The East Coast, yeah. Jesus has a cottage in. Okay, so the events had the opportunity for you to talk about helping students engage with the scriptures, which isn't exactly our topic today. But I know that you were able to have lots of conversations with youth workers, volunteers, people that are listening. That these folks that are on the ground helping students to take the scriptures seriously, to have a real encounter with Jesus and the Holy Spirit. What were some of the interesting maybe moments or conversations that you ended up in at the events?
Yeah, for those of you who are listening who have been to the events, I mean, they're an incredible opportunity to connect and to learn and to grow and to know, I think, more than anything that you're not sort of in this youth worker, youth ministry, pastoring thing by yourself. I think beyond that, I'll share this because I shared it in Winnipeg and didn't share it in the other cities, but I've been around the youth worker community for long enough that I've gotten to play many different roles. Not as many as you, Jeremy, because you are like on the team subbing in, but like I was the games guy. I've done the one-on-ones. I've been like an exhibitor at a booth. I've done, you know, you name it. I've kind of been a part of it. And I've always said yes to being a part of it because I'm just so grateful. And the conversations are obviously just really rich. I think when it comes to the scriptures and helping, you know, people and helping their students engage the Bible, I think that I try to begin with the recognition that we're all kind of starting to recognize, which is the Bible is actually harder to understand than people told us. Like, maybe we were sold a narrative that, like, it's just really easy, and you pick it up and you read it, and you read it on your own, which is, as I always say, that's how good heresies are started, right? Reading it on your own. The good heresies. I like to throw in the word good just to make it more interesting, you know? But this, well,
even
this
as you say that, it makes me think, don't we teach that so often? Read it on your own. This idea of, like, let's give students the Bible and then just say, what is the Bible saying to you?
You
read the scripture. And that's an honest question oftentimes we ask, which can be a dangerous thing in lots of ways when you give it to, a grade 7 boy who's reading, you know, a bit about whatever it might be, you know, Lamentations and slaughtering, you know, doves for your sins. And how does he know what that says to him? That's a fascinating question.
It is a fascinating question. And I think, like, I love the Protestant impulse of our care for scripture and the sort of sacredness of quiet time. I'm not trying to say that that's all negative. I'm just trying to say that, like, what tools are in our tool belt to kind of adequately engage in reading these old texts on our own. And so part of even the conversations I was having within the community is, like, how do we start reading together collectively? How do we think about performing these texts for our students and inviting questions through performance? You know, we always think about a sermon needing to be explained the text, but what if we performed the text and then had time to discuss it together, which I'm sure many of you do. You're all really great and intelligent people, but these sort of conversations around how do we ourselves grow in engaging the scriptures? And in some ways, I'm probably a good Wesleyan, so, like, this is, I'm sorry to everyone else for what I'm about to say, but there's a degree to which I'm always thinking, I shouldn't expect people to engage in the Bible more than I myself am willing to engage in the Bible. And that's hard because that goes to, like, all the disciplines of, like, prayer and fasting, whatever that might be. But this invitation to how do we recognize together that the challenging nature of the scriptures is a feature and not a bug. So the Bible being difficult to wrestle with and wrestle through and understand is maybe actually a feature of these texts and not a problem with these texts. It's clear in everything in some sense that it needs to be clear about. But beyond that, there's so many other things that I think require us to do this collectively together, to read together, to learn together, to discern together. And so that was a big part of the conversations. And it seemed like youth workers were really grateful to be able to hear some of these things about, like, okay, so the Bible maybe actually is difficult in many ways to just sit down and read and understand. And that maybe should enable us to take a deep breath and to recognize that, like, the journey is long and the wrestle is beautiful. But I often use the analogy of wrestling with the angel who you then realize is Yahweh. Like, I'm just not going to let go of these texts until they, you know, jokingly I'll say reveal their secrets to me, but, like, bless me, you know, like, sure. I'm not letting go of this story or of this Jesus or of this crazy last text of the New Testament called Revelation until it reveals to me what it's about. And that might take some time.
Yeah. One of the things I heard you say, and I don't even remember what the venue was over the last couple of months, but you talked about how historically, you know, the idea of an individual quiet time is actually very new. That that if you go back, and I don't know if there's an exact timeline, you would say if it's 300 years or 500 years, but that people wouldn't be able to sit and have a quiet time in the morning and read the scriptures on their own. They would have to. The only way they could engage with them was in community and in a gathering of people. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, for almost all of church history, I mean, to go through a couple of quick examples, literacy rates were astronomically low in the ancient world. Maybe 5 to 10% is the estimate of how many people could actually read. Beyond that, the canon wasn't actually formulated until the 400s. So then you're in the situation of, like, well, what did all the earliest followers of Jesus do for quiet time, you know? And then beyond that, the printing press didn't happen until, like, 500 years ago. And then even still, you'd have to assume that someone could both read and afford the texts of scripture. So it's really beautiful that we're able to do this, that we can carry around Bibles. I don't take that for granted for a second. In fact, I remember being in Chapters in Moncton years ago, and there was a Bible there that had one of those signed by author stickers that someone had put on it. I'm assuming it's a joke, which really made me laugh. Like, You can buy this Bible signed by author. I just thought that was amazing. This notion that we can have these texts is beautiful, but yes, if we're going to think about how ancients have and are the great communion of saints, as the Creed puts it, the great tradition that we carry together, they would not have largely read these texts on their own. They would have read them in community with a kind of guide, a priest or a pastor, or someone who's like, you know, leading them through understanding these texts. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. This is good. It makes me think. So, Cody, we were talking even earlier as this podcast, you know, we aim to have the answer practical questions that volunteers are asking.
Yeah.
And to be honest, as we were getting ready for this conversation, I realized so often these podcast conversations are the practical in the sense of like ministry skills that we talk about. And so,
yeah, which is so important.
You kind of get that, which is very important. But as we were coming into this, I'm like, ooh, I'm actually really excited to have a conversation that is a practical conversation about engaging the scriptures, but from a theological standpoint. And so if you're listening, just hear me wrestling with the fact that maybe these are the kinds of conversations we want to infuse this podcast with more going forward. And so perhaps, Cody, you'll be back lots more if you would join us. Okay, so you've written this book, you've co-written this book on Revelation, and we've got that linked in the show notes. We think that's really valuable. What we really want to know is when you read into Revelation, I mean, this is one of those books. If we ask students, church kids in particular, hey, what do you want to know more about? What do you want to study? What do you want us to teach on? Revelation often rises to the top because it seems like it's one of those things that has, there's so much intrigue in it, and yet it's hard to wrestle to the ground. And so as you were, you know, writing this book and doing the research and all that kind of stuff, what are some of the wild and crazy things that you experienced that are like, oh, wow, this is probably not actually as helpful as we might think as Christians trying to understand this last book of our New Testament?
Yeah.
Because I think we've seen it, and I think some of us would maybe be surprised at what we've actually been influenced by when it comes to the reading of this book.
Yeah, I mean, I think like, so I didn't grow up with any of this. So I'll speak on behalf of my wife for a moment. Babe, if you're listening, I'm just going to talk on behalf of you for a second. My wife grew up in, you know, what we would call, I mean, the technical term for it is dispensationalism. We could call it the left behind approach. In our book, mm-hmm. we call it the speculator's approach. And so a lot of people have just been taught Revelation is all about speculation. And so when you read it, you're just thinking about, well, is the locust an Apache helicopter? Is it a B-52 bomber? Is this the COVID vaccine? Is the mark of the beast what Elon Musk is doing? I mean, these are big questions, right? I mean, beyond that even, you know, Trump's okay sign that he often makes, if you think about it, it makes a six. So there are many people who have said, oh, he's doing the 666 sign all the time. I hope many of you are laughing because this is so hilarious. They're like, he must be the Antichrist. Beyond that, I mean, I'm joking for those of you who don't know me, every good cult, but honestly, most cults, Revelation has played a role in the formation of sectarian, we wouldn't call them Christian, but like deviations from Christianity in modern times as cults. And so there are so many bizarro ways. And I'm not saying that in a rude way to shame anyone. I've just noticed like it's so strange in two directions. One, first century people who would have been in these churches in Western Asia Minor, modern day Turkey, they would not have thought about any of these things. These would not be the categories that they would be using to, they would have understood this text in the first century. But then beyond that, I just know a lot of young people. So let me just, we'll come back to this, just young people for one second. I like to consider myself young. I'm getting older, but I'm still young. Young people basically are like, they know the speculator or this bizarre left behind approach. They have some understanding that maybe this is not right, but they don't know what is. And so they would rather sort of almost remove Revelation from the New Testament and just let's be silent about Revelation and not talk about it rather than engage in it. And so you get these two extremes of everything is a sign of the times, but for our time right now, or I don't really want to talk about this because it's kind of crazy and bizarre. And there's almost no in between of those two things I find often.
Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, I did grow up with those books, but also, you know, all sorts of other readings and understandings. But Revelation has always been this idea that there is an end to this age and that mm-hmm. the Christian teaching is there will be an end. And when that happens, this is the instruction manual for what all that entails. And so has that been the case that Christians for 2,000 years since the writing of Revelation have been waiting for and assuming that they're maybe living in the last days or the end times? Or is this something that's more recent in people's understanding?
Yeah, it's a nuanced answer, isn't it? Because John says on several occasions, the writer of Revelation, he says the time is near. And so there's a degree to which since the cross, as Paul says to the Corinthians, as it says in Acts, like the end of the age has come upon us. We are all living in the end times. Whatever, you know, for the New Testament, that means clearly something different than it does for us. And then that language gets imported into, so that's the one end. And then on the other end, it would be what you're describing, which is people saying, well, the rapture is about to happen. That becomes a term that gets swept up into this bundle of terms. And then the tribulation is going to happen. And that's going to be, God's going to sweep a bunch of people out of here. And some of us are going to get left behind. And then Salem Kerbin wrote a book, Survival, you know, Surviving the End Times or whatever. Just this roadmap for when everyone else is raptured and the cars go careening and planes are crashing. And it's basically The Last of Us. For those of you who are watching The Last of Us on HBO, it's basically that. But now you have a roadmap for like how to live. And so the first version, which is the end of times has come upon us. What does it look like to be faithful to Jesus in this moment? First century people would have thought about that. They would have understood that. This latter version of being raptured, tribulation, some of these types of ways of thinking, they're much more modern and influenced by Hal Lindsey into Left Behind, Salem Kerbin, all of these, this bundle of sort of commentators, if you will. The Scofield Reference Bible also plays a role in this, but no, they would not. To answer your question, in the way that I think you're asking the question, they would not have thought of this speculator approach in the first century. Absolutely not.
So yeah, when you say speculator, so because I guess when I say the end times, even if there's a different way of approaching them, approaching what we think of as end times, I think oftentimes, at least for me, and maybe again for a lot of people, it really is like, no, there's a definitive end. There's like this, the like you said, tribulation, rapture, whatever that actually looks like. You know, maybe that's confusing, maybe it's different, but like, no, like our time on this earth dramatically changes all of a sudden. And right. So in that sense, that's still in that speculation. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, inevitably, and this is important, Christianity without the hope of the return of Jesus and the eradication of evil isn't Christianity. And so Revelation is very clear that there will come a moment where Jesus will return, he will put all things right, and he will judge. That Revelation does talk about that. What it doesn't talk about is that before that happens, there's a special period of time where some of us get blasted up into heaven, and other people get left here to try to figure out. You know, John says, you know, this is really interesting, and one of the things I say about Revelation is that we need to regain a kind of hospitality of hearing it for the first time, because we bring all these categories to the text and then we can't actually hear it for what it's saying. John says in chapter 1, the 9th verse, so we're 9 verses in, John says he's a fellow participant in the tribulation. So whatever the tribulation is, it's John sees himself as someone who is also a part of it. And so it can't be something that's solely future. I mean, he says so himself in the first chapter. And so we have to allow that to sink in a little bit. We have this great future hope, but Revelation, to get to the book a little bit here, Revelation is more about teaching us how to be faithful dissident disciples now, where we live, rather than what does it look like to get blasted out of here sometime later.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so maybe if I can quote you guys, which I think is fair because this is the book that we're talking about, I can quote you, and that's all right.
Of course.
You'll have to agree with the quote.
Oh, I love it. Yes, 100%.
Because obviously there's so much in this book, and so we're going to advocate people actually nab it, read it, and then discern and decide how they might, you know, if you're having this conversation with students, you can involve them in it. But you guys talk about how the book of Revelation, when read well, forms us into, so this is maybe not necessarily talking a bit specifically about the content, but about the what happens when we read it well, forms us into dissident disciples who discern corruptions in the world and church. Mm-hmm. So read well forms us into dissident disciples who discern corruptions in the world and church. So does that give a sense of maybe like the the point of Revelation? Is that kind of what's happening here, that this text is meant to do something maybe different than just give us a play-by-play of the end of the earth, that there's actually something more going on here?
Yeah. Yeah, let me take those piece by piece. Let's do three pieces, and I can pause in between if you want to interrupt me or call heresy or ask a question or whatever. Inevitably, it's obvious that the first thing about this book is that it's about Jesus. It's called the Jesus Christ Apocalypse. And apocalypse means unveiling or pulling back the curtain.
Jesus Christ Apocalypse where? Because we in our Bible, it's the title is Revelation.
Sorry, I apologize. It's the word apocalypsis in Greek. It's actually quite literally apocalypsis Jesu Christu. So it's the Jesus Christ Apocalypse. Which apocalypse, again, doesn't mean the end of the world or the destruction of all things. That's how we understand it now. In the ancient world, they would have understood it as like at a theater when the curtain gets pulled back and the show starts, or at a wedding in our modern times where they used to wear the big veils. I don't know if women still wear veils. It's probably not in anymore, but the woman comes down the aisle and then the veil gets pulled back. It is an apocalypse. I mean, this is an unveiling of this beautiful woman on her wedding day, so to speak. And this book is about the apocalypse of Jesus Christ. It's about the unveiling or the revealing or the showing of Jesus Christ. And so first and foremost, Revelation is about teaching us how to follow Jesus. And that should be really intuitive, because the whole New Testament is about, let me ask you, friends, do you know Jesus of Nazareth? Because if you don't, like, this is, you know what I mean? It's this whole notion of somehow we know that the New Testament is about, okay, the Gospels are biographies of Jesus. The letters are writing to these dumpster fire early Christian communities that are figuring out how to follow Jesus faithfully, as mostly Paul's churches end up being dumpster fires, apparently. And then we get into the Catholic epistles, and then we get into Revelation. All of it has to do with following Jesus. How do we do discipleship in the times that we live in? And Revelation 14:4 is one of my favorite verses in Revelation. People have been asking me to sign their copies of this book, which is so embarrassing. And I keep telling them, will destroy the resale value of the book. And if you know me, you know that I genuinely believe they should resell it and get their money back at the end. But everyone I've signed, I've cited Revelation 14:4, because in this beautiful vision, it's like these are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. So first, I'd say whatever Revelation is about, it has to be about Jesus and about seeing Jesus in the midst of times that are really challenging and difficult. I mean, I know for us, like, I'm a pastor, so let me preach for a second. I just know that over the course of these last few years, people have had tremendous difficulty seeing where Jesus is at work and hearing his voice through the pandemic, maybe through its loss of work, being at home with your family. There have been so many challenges that we've all faced, and I know we're out of it, but we're also dealing with the repercussions of it in some ways too now for many of us. And we're still recovering in many of our ministries from these things. And so it's almost like, hey, in the midst of really challenging things, how do you see Jesus and hear him? And so for these first century followers of Jesus who are living under Roman occupation, who are facing really difficult challenges, the first point of this book is I want to give you hope. Hope is the word of Revelation, by letting you see Jesus as he is. Now, once we see Jesus, he moves to these speeches towards the churches. And this is the part of Revelation that everyone preaches, and then they stop at the end of those speeches. We often call them letters, the letters to the seven churches. That's probably a categorical mistake, because they're a part of the broad... Revelation itself is all a letter. It's an apocalypse, it's a prophecy, and it's a letter. And so they're kind of speeches. They all begin with, "Thus saith the Lord," which is how all the prophetic speeches begin in the Old Testament. And so Jesus is saying what he loves about what's happening in these churches in Western Asia Minor, but then he's also speaking to the corruptions or issues in the churches that he sees. And what we get, I've often started using this phrase, what we get here in these speeches is Jesus's vision of the church. And part of what we're trying to argue that Jesus is saying in those speeches is that there's far too much of Rome, or in our context, maybe the world, maybe Canada, maybe US, whatever. There's far too much of Rome inside the church, or there's far, John's language is Babylon in the church. So we understand the issues that Jesus is addressing and correcting as marks of the broader culture that have influenced the church. And so the church itself has become complicit in the corruptions of the empire, so to speak. I know that's really complicated. Mm-hmm. We tease it out a lot in the book. Let me say one more thing then. Then Jesus also has his eye on Babylon in Revelation, which is Rome in the first century world. Peter says as much in at the end of his letter, right? Those in Babylon greet you. He's saying those who are in Rome greet you. There's a lot of Second Temple Jewish literature that uses Babylon as a trope. It's like a big insult. It's like calling someone Hitler. Last time I checked, that was not a really kind thing to say to somebody. It's like calling an athlete that cheats, you know, Pete Rose at one point in history. Like, whatever it is, these situations where we use a term that is really negative to describe something or someone. And so in this case, John and Jesus in Revelation are using Babylon to describe Rome. And so here's what we need. Let me tie it all together and then I'll stop for you, Jeremy. Babylon is timeless. There are always new Babylons that are rising up. So if it's Rome in John's context, it might be Maoist China, it might be Nazi Germany. It's these empires that rise up, that are anti-God, and they're opulent, and they're murderous, and they're militaristic. Our one summary word for them is that they thrive on a kind of domination and a kind of rulership. And so the letter of the Apocalypse, the prophecy of Revelation, is inviting us, one, to have eyes to see clearly where the powers of the empire are at work, to recognize, two, where those powers are at play in our churches, where the church has started to look more like the world than it does like the New Jerusalem, or God's vision for what the church is called to be. And then from there, through all of it, the thread of it is, how do we see Jesus clearly, and how do we follow him? So those are the three pillars or tent pegs of the book, if you will. And that would be like Revelation 1 and then all the way through, but then 2 and 3 for the speeches. And then the rest of the book really is largely about Babylon.
Okay, so a couple detail questions and then zoom back question. So the letters to the churches wouldn't have actually been individual letters to those churches. They would have been a part of this overall literature. That's what you're saying? Yeah.
Everybody would have heard everybody else's mail in this case, and they would have heard the whole thing. And there's a key here too, is like ancients love to hear things performed. I mean, mm-hmm. They're like us. They love to be entertained. So they would like pay people to give speeches. They would go to the theaters all the time. And so you have to think about Revelation as being performed in each of these churches. Not with the mispronunciations in the way that we read the Bible on Sundays, like none of that. Like, they had it memorized probably. They would have known it deep in their core, and they would have performed it and then had time for questions. And performance is so different, but each church would have heard this performed. That's the word we'd want to use.
Interesting. Oh, that's fascinating. Okay, and then when you talk about Babylon, this is always, because this is a confusing thing, I think, at least for me or maybe for all of us. Babylon was a specific place at one point in time in history, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I'll just say Zondervan is really clever because every marketing team is so clever. And apparently, though Scott and I have not received one, there is a keychain that has a little clock that says Babylon is timeless on it. I don't know. I've not seen one in person. I've just seen a picture of it. I'm like, it's good to know that I'm an author and I didn't even get one of these cool keychains. But
that's great.
Yeah, that's correct. So if you think about a biblical vision for the way in which patterns repeat themselves, or, you know, to use a reference that our friend Hakeem Bradley, who has also done some of these conferences over the course of the last few months, and he's also a fellow PhD student at Ridley. Hakeem would talk about sampling, like in hip hop, like the way the Bible samples various stories as it moves forward. And so, yeah, Genesis 11, you get Babel, and then you get these big bad empires that come along, and they see themselves as God's people, so to speak. They see their empire as like the empire of empires, and they're the people who dominate and oppress followers of God. Throughout the story of the Hebrew Bible, they send them into exile, all these things. So you do get a real Babylon, but then Babylon becomes an idea or a trope or a concept that then gets put on other nations and empires. So there was a real-time Babylon. And then John's point is like, oh, it's like Babylon's back all over again. Rome is just a new iteration of Babylon. But his point is like, every generation has its Babylons, and every generation has its beasts, and behind all of it is the dragon. And so there was a Babylon, absolutely no denial of that. But the way that gets picked up and used as a way to describe nations that are Babylon-like, mm-hmm. You get that into Revelation and then even beyond.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, so this is so helpful for all of us. It's giving us a different lens. I mean, when we read the full book, which again, we should do, it gives us, you know, better categories to think in. It gives us better, you know, ways to, again, interpret this text. So this bigger question, when students come asking, hey, I want to study Revelation, I mean, we're going to just buy them your book. Absolutely. That's the right call. But what should we do generally as youth workers when we recognize, oh, we're a little bit out of our depth, which I think, side note, should happen every time we approach the scripture and we realize, shoot, I'm way out of my depth. But we're called to disciple these kids. And so here's a bit of an aside. So as youth workers, you know, you're listening, you're a volunteer, you probably feel like, oh, when I feel out of my depth, I'll just like sit back into what I feel comfortable with. So I feel comfortable being a chaperone. I feel comfortable keeping these kids safe. I feel comfortable asking them about their basketball game or their sport, you know, or their interest or how they're playing Fortnite. But when we get to this discipleship bit and they're actually leaning into and we're needing to open scriptures together, like, I'm out of my depth. Cody, what do I do when I've got these students, when we're trying to understand this Christian scriptures? What should I do as a volunteer youth worker when approaching these kinds of things?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I would say first, the most intelligent thing I've ever heard someone say in my life is, I don't know. Hmm. The honesty of that is so humanizing, I think. And so to say, like, there are a lot of Christians that have, I mean, just as a starting point, just to say, there are a lot of people who are really confused by the last book of the Bible. So your questions are great. And then I think, like, and this is such a discipleship answer, but like, let's go on the journey together, you know? Like, mm-hmm. let's start to read it together. Let's start to talk about it together. Yeah, as a youth worker, you're going to need likely some additional resources. The Bible Project has done lots of really good work on Revelation. Our book, I would recommend Michael Gorman's book. And then Daryl Johnson, who is in Vancouver here in Canada, also has written a great book called Discipleship on the Edge. And using some of these resources, these are all accessible resources. This is not a commentary. We've not written a commentary. We're not trying to make it any more complicated than it needs to be. It's already really complicated. But I think being able to say, yeah, you know what? I don't completely know, but I know that it's about Jesus, and I know that it's a book about hope, and I know that it's a book about figuring out how to follow Jesus faithfully in really difficult and challenging circumstances. And so with that lens, let's like start to read and think about this together on this journey, and then welcome their questions. And I would say, this is what I said to youth workers about the Bible. I'm like, get curious, like start interrogating these questions, you know, texts for yourself, and asking the really hard questions that you yourself want to ask alongside your students. And that will teach them to be, you know, curious and to dive deeper and to recognize that there's so much more that we're going to discover on the journey together. You know, I wish that there was like a quick, easy solution to the Bible in terms of like, you just, you know, read this one book and then you'll have the whole thing figured out exactly how it's going to operate and work. And, but at the same time, I think that this becomes a blessing in that it forces us to slow down, and that kind of slowing alongside our students and to say, what do you see here? Man, I see Jesus all over these pages in this really particular kind of way. And then when you get into some of the more complicated sections of something like Revelation, what does it make you feel? That's such a good question, because the texts are designed to make, if they're for performance, and they're going to make you feel something. And a good example of this, to use one from Revelation, not to get too complicated, but in chapter 6 and 7, you get seal 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You get the 6 seals. And then you expect the 7th seal, but it doesn't come. Instead, you get this like vision of Jesus on the mountain and this beautiful vision of hope. And so my question would be, what does this do for us? Wow, first, it makes me feel really disoriented when all of these seals are being opened and these weird judgments are coming out, and it seems looming and large, and it seems like it's going to overtake us and overthrow us. And then when you're at the pinnacle of disorientation, it lifts you out of it and shows you Jesus. It's almost like it wants you to feel like there are all these crazy things happening in the world around you, but remember the great hope in the midst of all of it. And so what does it make you feel is like such a beautiful question, I think. Confused is a good answer, but I think that hope is at the core of it. And the book, and let me say this, the book sometimes does want to make you uncomfortable. I think it's written to do that. And so how does it sweep you out of that once it's ushered you into it? But I would just say, let me summarize. I would just say, take a deep breath. You're doing great. the fact that you are having these conversations with your students is like such a win. And I think being open to learning alongside of them, where we're not just giving them simple answers. That's what I've learned, is like, how do I enter in alongside of them and not just give them, because people come to me all the time, like, you're a Bible guy, just tell me what this passage means. And it frustrates people because I'm like, oh, well, what, when you read it, what do you see? And what are the details that make sense to you? And I want to go on the journey alongside of them. I don't just want to give them answers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, two giant things there that I think are so valuable for us. Number one, how does this make you feel? That's not been a question. And maybe you're listening and you're like, I ask this all the time. Why is that so easy for you, Jeremy? It's like, well, because of my own inability to feel things. Maybe I've got a shallow heart. But
absolutely.
But like, what a question to ask in discipleship and in scripture reading. Hey, as we read the scripture, how does this make you feel? And gosh, we're not chasing our hearts everywhere and seeing exactly where they go, but like, just to allow that to be a part of the experience is so interesting. I've never really, again, heard that before.
Or can I say something to that? I don't mean to interrupt.
Yeah.
Because on the chasing the heart clarification, I would say it's not like, oh, it makes me feel warm and fuzzy, or it makes me feel, ooh, it makes me feel icky or whatever. Maybe it actually is written in such a way that it wants you to feel icky. You know, like, I think that's something we don't think about, even with violent texts sometimes, that maybe violent texts are trying to make us feel like, oh, I don't like this. And then we still engage. But we have to honor that feeling because, you know, good literature is always written to evoke that response inside of us. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so that's the first big thing. And then the other thing you said a couple times, which I think is so great, is that instead of trying to, and maybe I'll this is slightly rephrased, but instead of us feeling like as youth workers we have to teach something to our students, instead we're modeling what it means to journey into scriptures in community. And that actually is probably, well, I know, that is way more valuable. It is so much more valuable. As a volunteer, you don't need the answer. You're not there. You don't have to teach the particular, like, hey, this is the interpretation of this text and you need to know it beyond the shadow of doubt, write it and write it. But if you can show them what you do as a follower of Jesus, fellow on the journey in that discipleship, then they get to come along and see that. Ooh, that's so powerful. And those are the kinds of things that students will remember, and that will change their lives.
Of course. It's the youth pastor's favorite line, right? 1 Timothy 4, don't let anyone look down on you because you're young. And I'm like, just read a little further. After that, it says, but become a model.
Yeah.
It says become a type, right? Like, don't let anyone look down on you. Model it. And that's going to be the great witness. And so it's exactly what you're saying, is like, just model that journey for them.
Now, that's going to feel actually probably, you might have been listening to this hoping just to get answers, and now you're actually getting, it's going a little deeper to your soul, because it's actually a heavier weight. Instead of having to find the right answer, you're actually trying to live the right way. And as a youth volunteer, that requires more of you. But it is the better way for you personally. And I think it's the better way for our students. So I love that so much. Okay, Cody, this is tons. There's lots here. And obviously we haven't even, you know, scratch anything. So if volunteers are listening, we're going to put the book in there. If they've got other questions, they're going to reach out to me. And so I'll bring them back to you, and maybe we'll have deeper conversations on some of the specifics. I want to know if the locusts are indeed Apache helicopters for sure. And if I should stockpile food for the next, you know, for at least 2 years in my basement. But we'll save that for another, another episode. And in the meantime, is there anything else that you want to say before we wrap things up here with our youth workers today?
Yeah, I think anytime we get into talking about the last book of the Bible, it's really complicated. So let me just say again, bless you on the journey of following Jesus. Revelation wants to show you that in the midst of a lot of confusion and hard times, Jesus is there, if only we can see with the curtain pulled back. There are issues in our churches, and Jesus is addressing them himself and invites us to also correct and address those. And then there are issues in our world and things that we need to resist. And so one of the big terms that I'll leave us with is, how do we be a witness in all of these spaces to who Jesus is and what he's doing in our churches and in Babylon? So bless you guys on the journey. I hope there's something in here that's helpful for you. The book is readable for normal people. That's always my joke, because there's so many books on Revelation that are so confusing. So pick it up, read it. Buy it, don't buy it, give it to someone you dislike. That'd be great too. That's often my joke. But thank you for what you're doing. I'm so grateful as a pastor in Canada alongside of you, as a father of children who will one day be in the hands of really great youth workers like you, I'm just really grateful for the work that you're doing.